Good. Many days of practice, many tools, and probably still many questions. So I would like to pick up some of the questions that have come up via little notices and queries I have fielded here and there. One of the questions was regarding those five ways of dealing with thought. I'm afraid I have no Hebrew translation, I don't even have an English translation of this, so I can't hand out sheets. But I can repeat them once more. And if you really want to know about them, I haven't invented them. They are from the 20th discourse in the middle-length sayings. In the, they can be found. The discourse is called Vitakka Santana Sutta. And this discourse mentions these five ways explicitly. What it doesn't mention is some of the antidotes, and what it doesn't mention is some of the interpretation. These interpretations come from different parts and places in the Buddhist teachings. But they are all five of them are explicitly mentioned. So if you want to check them up, please go to the middle length sayings, Majjhima Nikaya, number 20, Vitakka Santana Sutta. Let me simply reiterate them. So for those of you who want to listen to them again, the first method and by far the most recommended one is simply not paying attention to a recurrent thought that comes up. Yeah? We are speaking now not of a relationship to thinking in general, okay? We are speaking about formal meditation practice. This is not the Buddhist take on thinking in general. Yeah, this is five ways of dealing with repetitive, disturbing thoughts that come up in your formal meditation practice. This is not to be done with every thought, and you may decide to actually investigate some of these thoughts, yeah, as I have suggested on other occasions. But if you want to just make the mind more quiet, and if you're in the samatha part of your practice, then these five ways of dealing with thought may be useful. The analogy for the first method of not paying attention to a thought that comes into your mind is like a man who walks on the road and somebody comes, crosses him. Yeah. And instead of looking at this other person, we close our eyes. Yeah, and wait till the other person has crossed us, and then we open our eyes again. Now, that's the analogy. The second method is more complicated, and it is particularly appropriate when we recognize that the thought that comes to disturb us is of unwholesome nature. Unwholesome insofar as it may be colored by desire, greed, wanting, or unwholesome in nature insofar as it is colored by aversion or rejection or hatred. So if it is desire, and if this desire focuses on a human being, it may be useful to consider an aspect of that human being that we deem to be unattractive. Yeah? Since beauty is skin deep, and since much of the attractiveness of human beings hinges not so much on a detail, but it hinges also on leaving things aside in our perception, on careful editing in our perception, gentle airbrushing here and there. So one of the ways to focus on something unattractive in somebody who is very attractive to us can consist on looking what is not nice in this person. Her smile stops too soon. Yeah. Or we can consider an aspect we feel is less attractive, an ugly movement, or we just might look a little more close, or see that the attractiveness is very much due to our wishing. Sometimes it is our wish and our desire that makes things actually attractive, that something that is quite normal suddenly looks incredibly alluring, simply because we project on it. Much of beauty, particularly the sort of beauty that attracts us, has to do with a projective ability of the mind. We put that which we feel attracted to actually out there. We fantasize. We embellish. So, just focusing on something that is not so attractive helps us. If the desire is focused on things, it may be worthy to contemplate how expensive these things are, how much work we have to do, how much maintenance they are, that these things are impermanent, that we can't keep them, that these things are composed of elements. So if we feel attracted to a particular object that is non-human, we can contemplate its composite nature, we can contemplate its inherent impermanence, we can contemplate that it is composed of elements, for example, or we can just think of how much work, how much effort, how much pain it is to actually obtain this, to keep it, to maintain it, to defend it, things like that. If we're dealing with anger, then generally the thing that makes us angry is people. We can with great gain contemplate the human nature of that being that makes us angry. We insist that this being is a human being, and we try to consider that this human being experiences pain. Like us, this being also experiences pain. Like us, this human being also wishes to avoid leave him here, it's okay. He's okay. Escorted. So, like myself, this other human being wishes to have happiness and to avoid pain. If you consider the degree that other human beings are afflicted by pain, then suddenly they become human again. We can't really completely throw them out, because that is what hatred, that is what aversion does. It takes the humanity out of the other human being. If in the process of contemplating somebody else's pain you suddenly begin to enjoy this, then something has gone wrong with your compassion exercise. Then you've moved over to cruelty, remember, and you've moved over to the far enemy of compassion. So at latest at that point you have to stop. If your thought is simply repetitive, if your thought does not hold either overt desire or overt aversion, but just keeps kind of warming up lukewarm things, you kind of keep repeating nonsensical stuff, it is very useful to contemplate the urgency of practice, the urgency, the fact that time is limited, that attention is limited, that you have come into this situation to meditate, to find some clarity, stillness, specific insights, and just wasting your time by warming up old thoughts is putting your time to very bad use. So you may consider that you may die, and you do not know when you die. You may consider that human life is precious. You know? You may get reborn as a mushroom for the next 300 times. So this is your chance, or as mosquito swarm. You know? Depending on your meditation state, and if you just keep thinking, yeah. Ajahn Chah once said, when one of his disciples told him, "I can't believe, you know, a big human being can be reborn into a small mosquito." And Ajahn Chah said, "Well, maybe not one, maybe, you know, 10,000 of them." So, a very effective way of cutting through repetitive, nonsensical chatter in your mind is just to contemplate your own death. You know? The fact that you're going to die. Yeah? And because you're going to die, that means you will not have time eternally. And because you don't have time eternally, it means some things are more important than other things, because you don't have time to go through all of them. And if you don't have time, you better start with the important ones. So what is important, more important than thinking all thoughts? So this is the end of method two. This sounds more complicated than it actually is, because you recognize quite easily that there is desire in a thought, there is aversion in a thought, or this is just apparently harmless little chattering of your mind. And some of the stuff you just need to cut through. You just need to say, "Stop, I'm not going to think this. I have enough of this. Thank you very much. I've listened to you 30 years, that's enough." Or something like that. Just be resolute. The third method consists in considering that the thought that comes to you, if followed, takes you to a place that is completely contrary to your values. Yeah. The thought, if you follow that thought, takes you to a place you know to be depression, or you know to be anger, or you know to be helplessness, or you know to be jealousy, or you know to be longing. Yeah. These are overt examples, or just confusion. Yeah. So while the analogy for the second method is the carpenter tool, I forgot again, the wedge, yeah, you take a small wedge to hammer out a big one, or the image of the needle with which you take out the thorn, yeah, both apparently similar, but the thorn is in your flesh, and then you fish out the thorn with the needle. In other words, by taking the energy of an unwholesome thought, you try to gain an element of wholesomeness. The energy can be transformed into a wholesome thought. The analogy for the third one, as you remember, is the dead animal you hang around your neck. You go to a party, you want to be pretty, and instead of adorning yourself appropriately, you hang a dead, rotting animal cadaver around your neck. Yeah, and you thereby do precisely the opposite of what you want to achieve, namely be attractive. So by following the thought, I do precisely the opposite of what I want to achieve, namely find stillness, find clarity, find understanding. Method four consists in acknowledging the amount of your doing in the thought that apparently comes from outside. You acknowledge your own responsibility in the thinking process. The analogy is simple. It says, there is a man running, thinking, "Oh, I am running. How if I was run more slowly?" And running more slowly, he thinks, "Oh, I'm still running. How about if I was just walking?" And walking, he would think, "Well, walking, maybe I can walk more slowly." And walking more slowly, he thinks, "Maybe I can stand still." So in the same way, we gradually acknowledge our doing in the thought process, our involvement and responsibility in the fact that these thoughts keep coming. And when we do that, we start having a little bit of leeway how these thoughts go. We can think them more slowly, or we can change our voices, or we can exaggerate them. Yeah? That's, for me, very effective. I have a little bit sort of an unhappy voice, and then I exaggerate, you know. I speak to myself in really dramatic tones. So by that we gain power over the thought. The thought is still here, it doesn't stop, but by changing the thought we stop being victims. Yeah, we become more responsible and also more powerful. And at the end of it we can drop the thought, or we can bring it to a still stand, or we can hollow it out. Yeah. So method four. Method five is the last resort. It's the last, the least recommendable. It is basically called suppression. The image is quite clear, as if a stronger man takes a weaker man by the shoulders and pins him to the ground. Yeah. So the meditator, the yogi, clenches his teeth, presses his tongue against the palate, and crushes mind with mind. Yeah. In other words, we decide that a thought is too dangerous, too destructive, too upsetting, too expansive, too mad, or whatever, that we do not allow to have it. We do not allow it to take hold in our mind, and we suppress it. Needless to say, this is not pleasant as an experience. It takes considerable effort. It leaves psychologically, it creates some collateral damage. And most importantly, this is a process that needs to be acknowledged. Yeah. If we suppress without acknowledging that we suppress, we are going to create problems. Problems of the sort that you're going to dream of later on. Yeah. So we need to plant a flag. When we bury something, when we suppress something and decide, this I'm not allowing in my mind, and we need to acknowledge that we do this. Otherwise, this will seep into our unconscious and haunt us later. In other moments of our life, in our nights, in moments when we are less, when we're off guard. And if we do that kind of thing, suppressing of impulses or thoughts, then we need to acknowledge this. So these are basically the five ways of dealing with repetitive, disturbing thoughts, of which the first method is by far the most recommendable. The second one is doable, but is complicated, yeah, because it involves some thinking. Is this greed? Is this anger? Is this just chatter? It involves actually engaging the thought, trying to counteract it. So it takes you definitely further away from your original meditation object than, say, the first method. The third method is particularly good for tenacious desire and anger patterns, because they are very familiar to our mind, and when they are familiar, you can appeal to yourself that if continuing to think that way, you are going against your better knowledge. The fourth method is very powerful. Although it sounds a little complicated, it actually is a very transformative and a very empowering experience to accept ownership of the stuff we think. I know people who can sit here and they have, you know, fantasies for days, and they keep believing that basically it's not them that's doing it. Yeah. It's a sort of, we don't know who it is, but it just happens. Yeah, it just happens. Now, to be honest with you, I've never heard anything quite as stupid as this philosophy that things just happen. Yeah. Things never just happen in my books. Yeah. They always have conditions and reasons, and there is always a force that propels them. If you pretend that they just happen, yeah, you just happen to have thoughts you like and you fantasize and sit and daydream here for days, and this just happens to you, you know. I cannot really follow that reasoning. You know. If things keep happening to you of that nature, then you're doing something for it. You know. You can't pretend that you have nothing to do, that you're just kind of happily at the receiving end of some fantastic sex fantasy and you have nothing to do with it. It just happens. You know. That, I think, is called denial. Yeah. So, it is important that you're straight with yourself. Yeah. That you're acknowledging the forces at work and the forces that propel the thoughts, that you are not just a victim of unpleasant thought or the happy bystander of pleasant thoughts, you know, that you are actually, that there is a part of you that is interested in this. Even ugly, unpleasant thoughts you may be very interested in, because maybe they stop you from meeting the fear that you would feel if you didn't have the thought. Yeah. But the mind is tricky. The fifth method, again, is an emergency measure. Yeah. Use it for particularly destructive impulses. Don't overdo it with its application. Most things are handled with by any of the four methods are much better than with the fifth one. It's just to know that you have this possibility of the fifth one gives you some certainty, it gives you some safety. The capacity to know that I can restrain my destructive impulses is quite useful to have, particularly if you don't actually need to apply it. Yeah, but just to know that it's there, it's in place, yeah, it's good to know. Good. So, let me switch topic to something else tonight. Yeah, please.
A small question. What is the difference between the first and the fifth? I mean, if you don't pay attention to the thought, it's not like suppressing it?
No.
So, technically, what's the difference?
Well,
if you don't give attention.
In the first one, you simply do not acknowledge. Yeah, you do not enter into debate with it. Yeah. You do not entertain it. You do not meet it, you do not speak with the content of the thought. You just say, okay, thought, close your eyes, I'm not interested in your rucksack. Yeah. With the fifth one, generally it is a stronger quality that needs suppressing. Yeah. It's a clearly destructive impulse. It's a thought that carries more intention. And in the fifth one, you hold it. Yeah. You don't allow it to take root. You don't allow it to grow. You put your mind forcefully onto something else. Are you with me?
It sounds like it's a bit the same. I mean, you just draw your attention.
I don't know what kind of thoughts you... you know, my thoughts, they come in varying degrees of intensity, yeah? So, some just kind of, they test you, you know? They kind of, they ping you, yeah? And say, ding, open port or not, yeah? And on the first one, you just say, no open ports, you know? Stealth mode, not even responding, yeah? Just nothing, no echo. On the fifth one, you have a powerful rupture of your security vessel, okay? And something needs to be stemmed, you know? You need to put the finger on there, otherwise the water is gushing in. It is very different in terms of volitional quality. The first one is just simple non-engagement. Yeah, it's kind of, you kind of, it is as if you move slightly aside and this one goes past you. Yeah, the fifth one, you kind of, you wrestle him down. Okay? Good.
I just see how to wrestle down in the mind, but you know what I mean.
Well, the fifth one, you engage. Yeah, the first one, you don't engage. The fifth one, you engage, and you say no. Yeah. You call upon your inner warrior and say, no, I am not going to continue this thinking. I am not going to follow through with that thought. I do not allow this to take space in my inner realm. This is a warrior pose. Yeah. The first one is more kind of like Aikido. You just kind of move slightly aside, and it goes past you. Please.
What about importing them into our daily life? I mean, why it is not recommended?
These techniques?
That? Yeah.
Well, look, these are meditative techniques. I mean, if they're useful in your daily life, there's nothing that speaks against them. I just want to make clear, you know, that this is not the general Buddhist approach to thinking. Yeah, some people, they make out of these intervention techniques that are geared for a formal meditation period. they make out of them philosophical statements. This is what Buddhists think about destructive impulses. You should suppress them at all cost. Yeah, across the board. In your life, in meditation, with your kids, and all this, yeah? And sometimes it's, you don't need to suppress your destructive impulses. Sometimes it's necessary that your kids realize that you're angry. You know, it's pedagogically necessary. It may not be good for you, but for them it's necessary. Yeah. So I'm wary that people make out of very specific statements for a specific context like formal meditation, that they make general Buddhist attitudes to world, life, and the universe. Yeah. If they're useful in your everyday life, fantastic, you know, use them. Okay, let me switch to where I would like to go for tonight. I'd like to zoom out, you know, from the local area of dealing with disturbing thoughts to bigger. I would like to speak in non-Pali terms about stages of meditation which are crucial to be truly Buddhist mind training. Yeah? So, let me say there are four stages. I know you have learned many lists this time, you know, three of this and five of those and seven of these and four of those and eight of those and 12 of those. Bear with me, this one is not from the Pali canon. This one is an attempt to make a little synopsis of four different stages that any serious meditation practice will need to encompass if it is going to be doing something like the Buddha had in mind. Yeah, there are many different ways you can go and learn types of meditation that are very that are called meditation. In Europe, many priests call their Sunday sermons meditations, or you can go to Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and learn TM meditation, or you know, there are different types of meditation. But let's speak about Buddhist meditation and speak about the notion of what the Buddha called bhavana, yeah, development, unfolding. So the first of those stages entails stilling, calming, settling, down-modulating, becoming quiet. Yeah. There's no way around this one. However you're going to call your practice, Dzogchen, Chikantaza, choiceless awareness, there will be an inevitable necessity to dedicate some of your energy and some of your time to calming your mind. There is no doubt in my mind that this is an indispensable stage of practice. Whatever you feel your school or your method entails, you can't just sit down on the ground and do vipassana. You will be, if you try to do that, simply thinking. Footnote, the way I have come across the term vipassana in the scriptures, generally it does not mean something you do. It is not a practice. Vipassana is the fruit of a practice. The last couple of years, this term has become a term that denotes a practice, is mainly a Western invention. Not just a Western invention, some Burmese have helped it along, but basically it's a very Western take, yeah, that vipassana is something you do rather than the fruit of meditation. If we look in the Buddhist teaching, 80% of the times when the Buddha uses the term vipassana, and he doesn't use it maybe that often as you might think. Yeah, he does never use it as often as sati. He does not use it as often as jhana. He does not use it as often as samatha, just to be clear. 80% of the time the word vipassana occurs, it occurs together with the term samatha. This is important. We haven't quite got that one straight, because here in the West we have a vipassana movement, but we don't have a samatha movement. This has something to do with the history of how Buddhist meditation teachings are received, particularly in the West. This has a lot less to do with Buddhist teachings, yeah, just to be clear on that one. The first stage, call it like you like, it's calming down, slowing down, getting the mind to be more slow, more still, more peaceful, more placid, more transparent. Yeah. And there are many methods that do that. Personally, I know no better method than to use the breath, but there are many methods how you can still the mind. Body sensations is something you have tried. Listening to sounds is something you have tried. You can use mantras, you can do metta practice, but you do need to still the mind. You do need to know skills and to have the patience and the outer conditions that allow you to make the mind more still. I wouldn't even say how still it has to get. That's not the point. The point is it has to be from the time you begin to the time you go to the next stage, it has to become more still, okay? And your skill is necessary and relevant to get it from wherever you are, however frantic, crazy, fragmented, stressed out you are, to less frantic, crazy, fragmented, stressed out. Yeah. Ideally, to quiet, very quiet, deeply quiet. Yeah. But it has to be a skill you develop to go from unpeacefulness to more peacefulness. Yeah. So that's an inevitable stage. I don't think there is a way around it. I find the most effective ways of doing this is taking a bodily process and focusing my attention on that bodily process with continuity and refinement. I know nothing better than the breath to do that. The second stage of any meditation practice is that I'm learning to take distance. Yeah. Taking a step back from the content of my experience. In other words, being able to make a distinction between mind and mind content. If you have a glass of water and in there is sand and you shake it and move it, you know, it's all troubled. The sand in it and the water are in movement and the water looks muddy. If you place the glass there, what happens is that after a short while the sand will slowly settle and the water will be clear. You have the sand at the bottom and the water at the top. This is the nature of mind. Mind and its objects are different. If you stop shaking up the mind, if you stop disturbing the mind with sensory objects or with inner agitation, then the mind will become more still. Yeah? It's in the nature of the mind to become more still. It likes stillness. It knows stillness. It longs for stillness. So if we stop agitating the mind, it will do that. And one of the things that happens is that there is a difference between the foreground and the background, a difference between the object and the space the object inhabits. So stage two of meditation consists in disidentifying from the stuff that goes on in my mind. Disidentifying from emotion. There is emotion. This is not my emotion. I am not the emotion. There is emotion. There are thoughts. These are not my thoughts. I don't owe them. They don't make up my identity. In other words, I can move back. Think of a stage, and while we're pretty busy and identified with our thinking and our feelings and our emotions, we are on stage. We keep acting the things out that are happening in our mind. If we learn to disidentify, suddenly we have a stage, but we are no longer on it, you know. First of all, we're close to it, and then we are further away. Yeah. We gain more distance, we gain more perspective, we gain more retreat. Yeah. We have more perspective, more openness. That's a very, very important stage of practice. For many people, this is what meditation is about. being able to distance one's own experiences and going to a place where it's peaceful, where it's quiet, where I can't be hurt anymore. Yeah, for many people, this is what meditation is in principle. I can finally control my experience by not feeling it, by distancing enough, going away far enough so that it doesn't hurt anymore. Yeah, I can do something in my head that I don't have pain anymore. Fantastic. Yeah. This is very normal. This is very understandable. At the same time, it's only a part of meditation. It's only a part. A useful part, an indispensable part. But if we stick to only that part, then we will never transform anything. All we do is dissociating. That's the poo-poo word for disidentification and going away from things. Yeah, we dissociate and stop being the actors on stage. We become the spectators. Yeah, well-paying spectators down in the first row, cheap spectators, peanut benches very, very high up. Yeah, this is an important, crucial stage, but unless it is followed by the next stage, it will only ever help us to distance our own experience and will make us very weak. If we stay distanced from our own experience, we will have less pain, we will be less involved, we will be less identified, but we will be helpless out there. The farther out you go, the less you can understand, the less you can transform, the less you actually feel, and the less changes, because as soon as you go back in, the problems are there. Yeah, you have not actually changed anything. You have not resolved anything. You have not transformed anything. So the next stage, stage three, or you could call, you need to fathom something. You need to investigate. You need to research. You need to go into. Once we have established that we can go away from the things that are challenging, flooding, dangerous, painful, making us crazy. Once we have established that we can go out and stay out, yeah, we voluntarily go back in. Yeah, carefully, respectfully, very, very properly negotiated. We go back in and see, what is it really what makes us crazy? What is it really what I desire? What is it really what I'm afraid of? What is it really what makes me so angry? Yeah. So the very things we have learned to distance ourselves from and to disidentify from, those very things we go back in and investigate, one on one. Yeah. We go only as far in, or as fast in, as we can make sure that we are not being pulled in, yeah, or snatched in, yeah, or reeled in, or whatever you want to call it. So this stage is, in many ways, this has a lot to do with citta upasana. It's kind of, it has to do with listening properly, it has to do with feeling more deeply, it has to do with receiving more profoundly, it has to do with being more at home in the things that have challenge, that hold pain, that hold confusion for us. This is a very difficult work, and sometimes people don't want to do this work. They just want to feel peaceful and hope that if they feel peaceful, they can actually go and live there. But generally, profound peace is the result of doing the work in stage three. Profound peace is the work, is the result of actually finding out the story. This story is inevitably personal, and it's inevitably bound up with our history, with our biography, with our temperament, you know, with our number, with our karma. There is no way around this. If we have done this work, then we reach stage four, and stage four is that the stuff we have understood on a personal level, in terms of our biography, our temperament, our specific suffering, yeah, which is different from his and from her suffering, once we are in stage four, we see that the things we have learned on our personal path hold universal validity. Yeah. we go back out and we see the pattern, we see the general dynamic of suffering, we see dependent arising, we see causality, we see what engenders freedom, we see how suffering comes about and how suffering can be resolved. Not just our suffering, but we recognize that in a way that is applicable to other human beings. Yeah? In other words, the sort of personal dynamic we have understood in stage three, we're gradually being able to discern in other people's lives, in other forms. We recognize the same pattern that we know from our story in his life and in her life. This is a very important step because that makes out of a personally one understanding a universal insight, something that is universally applicable. Good, that's it. No more complication. So, consider your own notions of meditation. Which of those stages are things you recognize? Which of your, which would you feel is really meditation for you? Which is not part of this? So it's important that you acknowledge to yourself your own notion of meditation. I told you very much at the beginning, I think, that my ideal world, we would all begin at zero, you know, with meditation instructions and with meditation practice. Yeah. We could all kind of go to a shared zero point, and then we could just download the Buddha, basically, and take it all from zero, and we would all be synchronous in our movement. But I also told you of my suspicion that whatever I say, you're going to hear what you already believe, and if I should contradict you, you're very likely to not pick up on where I contradict you, but simply just close your eyes and let that thought go past. Yeah? So, I haven't quite given up hope, and I suggest that you contemplate your notion of what meditation really is in the light of those four stages. Stage one, calming. Stage two, disidentifying, gaining distance. Stage three, crawling back in and humbly and carefully investigate the nature of our suffering, the nature of our constrictions, the nature of our attachments. Stage four, going back out and recognizing the personally understood pattern in terms of universal dynamics. Yeah, freedom, causality, factors of awakening, dependent arising, dynamics of suffering, specific dynamics of suffering. Yeah. I cannot blame the Buddha for these four stages. I believe that is what he teaches. I believe that these are inevitable stages in Buddhist meditation practice, although I cannot give you Pali terms for these. Just because it's four of them, and it's four of the Satipatthana, does not mean that the four Satipatthanas can be transposed one-to-one onto those four stages. There are some similarities. Stage three and Citta and Upasana have a lot in common, but you can't say, you know, first stage is Satipatthana 1, second stage is Satipatthana 2, third stage is channel 3, fourth is channel 4. It doesn't quite work that way. So it doesn't pan out completely. But consider the stages. Can I open up here? Can I stop and ask whether I can respond to questions to these stages? I feel they're quite important, and you have heard enough details of meditation instruction in the last couple of days. You probably figure out that some of those instructions fit into the various stages. Yeah. Good. Let me stop for a moment and see whether there are questions. Yes, but
I can understand the three first stages as meditation instructions. The fourth one, in my life, I understand it as something that happened after meditation. I want to ask if there is any meditation instruction for it.
Well, in some ways, you know, the instructions on Dhamma and Upasana is strange, yeah. But you get patterns, you get patterns of hindrances. You know, if you study how hindrances work, them. Some of that study has to do with your actual meditative experience, but also reflection afterwards helps. Yeah. So in many ways, like with many of these Dhammanupassana practices, of the channel four practices, they are not strictly formal meditation exercises. You know, you have things in there like the Four Noble Truths and the Five Khandhas and the Salayatana, the Six Sense Fields. So they're not technically really things you would want to take up in formal meditation practice. Lest it be very, very simplified. Yeah, it's just too complex. But you combine both meditative experience and reflection afterwards, yeah, to get at the universality of your specific meditative insight. It's more like a combining of personal meditative insight with a larger perspective on the teaching. So if you study dependent arising, obviously you can study that very theoretically, but it makes sense at some point to actually understand at least some features of dependent arising in terms of your meditation experience. You can study tanha, you can study, you know, pasa, vedana, tanha, upadana, bhava. You can study pretty much in your meditation. Yeah? And the rest of it you can patch in. Sankara you can study. Vinyana is difficult. Namarupa, not possible. Salayatana is also given. So they are not really good for meditation practice. But you can fill them in reflectively later on. If you have pasa, vedana, tanha, upadana, bhava, this is a very good sequence. Yeah, contact, feeling tone, thirst, grasping, becoming. This can be very practiced. Or even the one more, you know, after bhava, suffering. You know, there's the feeling, there's the contact, there's the feeling, there's the desire for the feeling, there's the becoming, the grasping of the becoming, and then bang, you're thrown onto a cliff, yeah? And you realize, you don't get the rest of the picture, but it keeps repeating and it makes kind of Pasavedana Tana Upadana, bang, and you're heard. Pasavedana, bang, you know? And you kind of keep reeling, oh, hey, there's a pattern there, there's a rhythm. This thing has a rhythm, you know? And one, a little bit, you start identifying certain salient points of it. And you realize, oh, okay, that was pasa. Now I'm latching on. This is pleasant. Now I want to have it. Now I engage. Now I try to get it, yeah? And now I succeed in getting it, and bang. So you keep connecting your meditative experience, obviously, with reflective patterns afterwards. That would be something like stage four. Sorry if that was boring for others. Please.
Can you explain the term dependent arising?
No, not tonight. No, not really. Not really. It's a profound teaching in the Buddha's path. And that profound teaching basically comprises the two noble truths, number two and number three yesterday, if we remember. The second one is the arising of suffering on the basis of a condition, on the basis of a cause. And the third one is the cessation of suffering after the falling away of that cause. So dependent arising is a detailed, quite meticulous structural pattern that stratifies in a differing number of links the arising of suffering and the cessation of suffering. To speak about dependent arising needs a little more breath than I have tonight, because we need to speak about differing terms, and then we need to map those terms in terms of our psychological understanding, and then we need to go back to the original map and see what in Buddhist teaching they are actually meant to be doing. Yeah, and then we again have to translate that into the language in which we reflect about ourselves. So this is generally a bit of cognitive effort, and it helps if you have some reading background in this. That's not something I would want to do right now in this meditation retreat. But it is interesting. I have done that a couple of years ago here in Israel, actually. So, also, it's not a secret. If you're interested in this, I'm happy to point out some reading for you. should you be keen. Yeah, there are about 80 different texts in the Buddhist Pali suttas that deal with dependent arising in one form or the other. So forgive me for not going into more detail tonight. No, it's meditation technique. So stage two, you know, disidentification is actually not difficult to explain. It's if you have a thought in your head, you don't believe it. That is disidentification. This is a thought. This is not my thought. This is not the truth. I am not the owner of the thought. The thought and I are two different things. The thought comes and goes. I can be aware that it comes and goes. Independent of its content, a thought has a particular nature. It has a speed. It has an appearance. It tries to catch my attention, and then it stops. I don't quite know where they come from, and I don't quite know where they go to. Yeah. Once you recognize this, then you are no longer preoccupied with believing the thought or fighting against the thought. You just see this is a thought. Yeah. You're not interested in talking to it. You're interested in seeing the universal nature of thought. This would be an act of disidentification. Yeah. Are you with me? Yeah, ideally I would suggest something slightly different. You know, ideally I would suggest that you hold 70% of your attention with the breath so that you keep feeling this. And then at the periphery of your mindfulness, you kind of have thoughts coming to visit. And you just let them swim through like fishes in an aquarium, yeah? Rather than counting them or trying to speak with them or catch their attention, knock on the window and say, you know... Or kind of make signs or things like it. You just kind of see, okay, this is the breast, I feel the breast, and there are fishes swimming, yeah, and they swim. Now, this is just what fishes do. They come, and then they do their number, and then they disappear. Yeah. So, you don't engage. With emotion, it's a little more difficult. You have to be more determined. Because emotions generally, they fill the space, yeah? They fill the space of the mind. They say, ooh, this is nice. I am very happy this is nice. Yeah. They say, okay, why is this happening? Yeah, it feels very nice. There is pleasant experience. There is joy arising. We want to see where this comes from. What is giving rise? Oh, I hear a nice sound. Or I smell a nice thing. Or I heard they opened the door to the dining hall. That means I get food soon, yeah? So you disidentify with that and you see the reason for joy. So you notice, this happens on the basis of a condition. They open the dining hall door, I'm in a good mood. They close the dining hall door, I'm in a bad mood. Yeah? No sweets tonight. So you recognize... the joy does not belong to you. The joy is conditioned. It's not the nature of your mind to be permanently joyous. The fact that you have joy is due to certain conditions. And you disidentify from those conditions. You don't own them. Or you disidentify from an emotion. You're angry and you say, well, there is anger, rather than I'm always angry. Yeah. It's a different statement. There is anger in my mind to I'm always angry. Yeah. You do not own the experience you have. That will be stage two. Stage three, you only do with things that keep recurring. Yeah. Things that you keep having in your mind as themes or as forms of suffering in your life. Once you have managed to disidentify and to stay outside of the problem for some time, you begin to be interested how you can come closer to the problem and see whether you can stay calm, and see whether the problem, if you come close, it changes a little bit. Sometimes the problem lets us in, yeah, gives us a perspective. Sometimes it dissolves. Sometimes a veil disappears and we realize that behind our anger was helplessness, or was grief, or was actually something else, yeah? Disappointment. Does that make sense? You can do that. In fact, I suggest you do that in meditation practice. It's forms of attending, forms of relating, forms of getting in touch with. And ideally, you don't lose feeling of your breath when you do that. So that part of your body keeps being in your mind. Part of your attention keeps being with the breathing. Yeah, please.
Do you think that this is something you could do on a daily basis? Like if you sit only for an hour a day or half hour a day, you think you can get to those stages? Or?
I think you can say, I would say if half of your time, at least half of your time, should go into stilling practices, basically whatever you do. You know, just our lives are busy, so give yourself, if you sit 40 minutes, give yourself 20, just do samatha exercises. And then you see what else is there, what stops you from getting deeper into samatha is generally the best choice, you know, the thing that is most obstacle to your samatha practice is the thing that then becomes your focus of intention. You stay with part of your attention on the breath and you try to bring that clarity, turn the light of that clarity onto this process, you know. Yeah.
On your last subject, before this one, you said take ownership over your thoughts. It made me a little... because I rather see my thoughts as the weather. Come and go. And I can take an umbrella. But and now you said that you don't own it. So I think there's maybe a...
contradiction, yeah. No, I'm for it. I'm afraid there is not. You know, it's you have to play different games. You know, with the thoughts that pretend to have nothing to do with you, there you have to take ownership. Yeah, because there you feel like a victim, or you just feel like a spectator. Those you have to admit that they have actually something to do with your desire and your aversion. But the thoughts that are part of an emotion, the thoughts that are obsessive, yeah. One way, if you know, these are big thoughts. The thoughts you describe, they're kind of, they look more accidental thoughts, yeah. They pretend to be not very serious, or they pretend to be fantasies. There you need to acknowledge your own responsibility. They still don't belong to you, but you have something to do with their appearance, okay? Because you want something, they come, yeah? They still don't belong to you because you can't own a thought, yeah? He can have the thought, yeah? You don't have a copyright on it. The thoughts that need to be distanced, they have an obsessive quality. They have a quality of more intention. There is more power there. And before you can work with them, you need to be able to say, this thought is not me. You know, this is a thought. It's happening. It has conditions.
So you avoid the blame?
For example, that's one of the advantages. You avoid, if you have a bad thought, you avoid becoming a bad person because of that. You know? Usually, well, you know how it works, yeah? You have a little thought, it comes here, and you think, oh, it's a thought, there's a thought coming, there's a thought going. Yeah? If the thought comes here, you believe it's me, you know, it's my thought. Yeah? I have it, also it's my thought. Yeah, the thought goes, and I'm the sort of person that my thought was like. Yeah? I have an angry thought, the thought comes here, this is my thought, then the angry thought goes, but I stay behind as an angry person. This is called identification. That's what Sandhya talked the other day about. She called it grasping or clinging. If that happens with thoughts, we call it identification. You know, me becoming the content of my thinking. Very dangerous, because you cannot control your thinking. We can think very inspired thoughts. We can think very ugly, mean, nasty thoughts, you know. And if we become identified with our thinking, we are in big trouble, because we can be dragged anywhere. This morning I was a nice person, you know, before I had the thought in my mind. Then I got up and I said something nasty to my fellow teachers. Then I was a nasty person. And then I was a little bit sleepy in meditation. I was a lethargic and sleepy person. And then I had a nice thought again. And then I had a nasty thought again, and so forth. You know? So I am stupid, I'm silly, I'm angry, I'm jealous, you know. And suddenly I become a jealous person, an angry person. Very big problem. So you want to distance yourself from some thoughts, because you're overly identified. The example you gave, it's thoughts I am totally disidentified with. I pretend they just come by accident. Yeah. Does it make sense? Little bit, yeah.
And maybe to make, to stir things up and not come.
You need to find out what relationship you have to thought, yeah? If you think that you have no relationship to them, this is not good. If you think that you're the owner of your thoughts, this is not good either, yeah? You need to find out. Some of them have something to do with your desire and your aversion and your wishes and your fears. Some of them you are overly identified with. You need to have more space, okay? Some people you want to have close. Some people are not close enough. Some people are too close, yeah? You need to learn this relationship with thoughts, like you learn with people. We're very good with people generally. We have a very clear sense who should be close, who should be less close, and who should be, you know, more close or further away. With thoughts, we're not so good. We either pretend they don't belong to us, we have nothing to do with them, or we take them and say they're mine. Yeah. Good, thank you. Yeah, please.
Can you please relate the stage 3 to things we have practiced here?
Yes, citta and upasana. If I asked you to ask questions, you know, say, what energy propels your thoughts? You know, what is this anger wind that blows the sails of your thoughts? Or is this desire wind? Or is this fear wind? Or is this confusion wind? Yeah, then definitely that would be inquiring. Particularly if you focus on something that you find is a recurrent theme in your practice, and I ask you to carefully approach this, to touch it more deeply, then this would be stage 3 practices, definitely. Yeah. Yeah.
But stage 3, isn't there supposed to be a psychological, how do you say, talich? Procedure, because as I got it, so stage 2 is to pass the superficial psychology structure of your personality, like the first layer, and then you go to the layer that makes you do those things or think those thoughts. But I mean, if I see that the anger or helplessness or safe hatred or something like that makes all those thoughts. I mean, how can I overcome this? I need to understand it, because there is a story there. I mean, there is a story that made me an angry person. I mean, and this is like my psychology, I think so. And maybe, so this is one. And also like about the detaching, if I want to detach it, it's like detaching my personality. I mean, like the whole structure, and this is like deep things. It's like things that has that with me since I was born, and like it's imprinted, it's in my body. So like, where is this like deep understanding of where the anger comes from? I mean, I understand it's universal, but
I'm not sure I understand the question.
I mean, I feel I'm like I understand 1 and 2, but like, and also 3, but it's like I feel I don't see the whole picture because I feel something is missing, because I'm sure it's not, and I don't understand. But
you know, if you want to speak about these stages in psychological terms, then this is not difficult, although the psychological terms don't do justice to the meditative approach, really. You know, the meditative approach does not consist of analysis, and it does not consist of observing. It consists of a deep and profound relationship, which entails a seeing through, but also a being in touch with. Yeah. So the first stage would be down-regulate. Slowing. That's not difficult to say psychologically. The second one is also easily said psychologically. It is really detachment, disidentification, getting perspective, that the capacity of mind that is capable of viewing, of being in touch, and of recognizing what's happening, that this faculty is different from the content it tries to recognize, it tries to be in touch. Yeah. At the worst, stage 2 is dissociation. You know, it's going away from. So generally, in psychology, this is considered not a good thing. It's considered a problem, and in fact, it is a problem for many meditators, because they just like to go away from the things that are painful, and they're not interested in finding out what exactly is painful. So they try to keep going away, and they're disappointed when coming back that the problem is still there, because they haven't done the homework. So this is what you find with many meditators. The psychological terms for stage 3 would be careful investigation, but with meditative stillness, not with intellectual analysis. It would be going to live more closely to the problem and feeling how the problem affects your whole system, your cognitive system, your emotional system, your somatic system. It is a form in Buddhist teaching you would call yonisomanasikara, you would call dhammavicaya, what we call vimamsa, you would call vichara. These are all terms for researching, investigating, profoundly studying, fathoming, kind of going in and finding out.
But it's, I mean, I'm finding out the story. I mean, I'm finding, it's like analyzing.
No, not really. That's thinking.
Yeah, so this is what...
You know, you can investigate without analysis. You can just kind of go and find out how it is if you go closer to a thing. What does it do to my body? How does it affect me cognitively? Can I be spacious enough to hold this experience? You know, you can investigate and explore a theme in your life without analytical thinking. You can do the analytical thinking afterwards. In meditation, it's not helpful. It's too discursive. It's too superficial. So for the sort of exploration I'm talking of, you need stillness. You know, you need to be able to feel continually your breath. You need to be able to actually go to bits that you're afraid of, and you feel the fear affecting you, and you feel that you can hold your breath.
So you're dealing with the cause of your thoughts,
right?
Your present.
You're dealing not with the thought. You're dealing with the raw,
cause, the
soul, yeah.
Root.
Yeah.
And without like just being there, and this makes will bring me the realization that will set, like that will free this root, and will.
You become more familiar with what is buried. Yeah, you become more familiar where the energy is held. You use the word personality structure. Look, in my books, personality structure is basically a defense. Yeah? Mm-hmm. All of your personality, your whole self, is one big defensive structure against pain. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And the way it is organized, I don't blame the Buddha for this, okay? This is me saying, this is my interpretation. But the way your self is organized says something about what pain you are most afraid of, okay? Against that structure, against that pain, yourself has basically structured itself. Yeah. If you are most afraid of being abandoned and left behind, then yourself has built its own structure to protect yourself against the worst case scenario, which is called abandonment. In other words, there is nobody there, I'm alone, what happens to me is of no significance to anybody, and I want to be able to survive that. That's my worst case scenario. If abandonment is your main fear. If your main fear is being overwhelmed, yeah, then your self-structure tries to protect itself against overwhelm. Yeah, there is somebody there, it tries to eat me. Yeah, it tries to squash me against the wall. I can't breathe enough. Yeah, so your whole self-structure is a defense against overwhelm, against some powerful influence that takes away the space where you could exist. So your whole psyche is going around this one. And you will find that in your meditation very easily. You'll be very concerned that other people take your seat. You will make sure you have your own cushions. You know, you'll be very concerned that, you know, nobody takes your space. Yeah. And so forth. You have whole stories of this. The things we are afraid of are not so different. I would say not even a half a dozen techniques. There's one that there is nothing out there for you, abandonment. The next one is that you're being eaten. Yeah, this is overwhelm. You know, I'm not safe where I am. I get kind of taken up, gobbled up. Yeah, so the second one is, yeah, this is this one. The third one is there is something there which I like, but it may be rejecting me. Yeah, so I fear there is connection. I would love to have connection, but it may be pushing me back. Yeah, so I try to protect myself against the hurt of rejection. Yeah. That's about it. There isn't really much more.
So I go like through the walls of my defenses, and I be there in with the fear and the with presence, and then I go and do it like with all the roots I have.
I would think, you know, your whole psychological structure, I would consider that a defense structure. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a defense against pain.
So I go into the pain, present, and then it sets the pain free.
Well, that's what happens. If you take apart the defense structure, you get back in touch with the pain. Yeah. You know, we can't tell that people. You know. So, but basically, that's what you do. Yeah. And then they find out they survive. Yeah. And then they're happy.
One more thing. How much time does it take?
Depends on your defense structure. I would suggest just do it as long as it takes. That's his idea, you know. Once you know what it is, and once you know the direction, just keep going. Just doesn't matter how long, keep going till you're there. Yeah. Last one, please.
The analogy of a man trying to find his face in the water.
Yeah.
And maybe you can repeat it or just tell me where can I find more information about that? Because I like the story too much. It's very pictured.
The story is called Sangarava Sutta. This is the name of a Brahmin, and it's to be found in the gradual sayings in the Book of Fives. Book of Fives, Gradual Sayings, that's the title of the collection of texts. And the name of the text is called Sangarava Sutta. It has a number, but I don't know it by heart right now. If you want to have the analogies of the water, yeah, we're speaking of the hindrances. These are the five hindrances. Remember, sense desire, ill will, number two, sleepiness and torpor, number three, restlessness and agitation, number four, and doubt is number five. And for those five hindrances, we have analogies. There is a man who tries to recognize his own face in the water, and he finds a vessel of water that is, for the hindrance number one, desire, the water is colored. And the face he recognizes in the water is distorted because of the color in the water. The water in the vessel for the hindrance number two is boiling, is bubbling. Because of the ill will, the water is throwing up bubbles, and our man cannot recognize his own face in the bubbly water. For hindrance number three, the water is mossy and covered with algae. That means, again, our man who tries to look into the mirror of the water surface cannot actually see his own face. Hindrance number four has, as water analogy, water surface that is whipped up by wind. Yeah. Again, the waves preclude the man from actually recognizing his own face. And just to be clear what the sutta says, his own good and the good of others, and both his good and the good of others. He's unable to recognize what is good for him, good for others, and good for both. The fifth water analogy is for doubt, and the water in the vessel is muddy and full of clay. So again, he can't recognize his own face properly, or he gets a distorted image of his own nature, and obviously what is good for him, what is good for others, what is good for both. Yeah? Yeah? Okay. Good. Can we be quiet for a minute and then do some recitation?